Shalom and welcome to Product Nation, a weekly podcast by product managers in Silicon Valley covering how tech product gets created and executed by some of the most accomplished product experts in the world. I am Ofer Barav, and today with me and my co-host Nir Paz, we welcome Noam Segal. Nir, ma shlomcha?
Hakol tov. The shelter-in-place order was supposed to be over by next week. Today we got an extension to the end of this month over here in California. So, you know, party goes on.
What do you think about the future of work? Do you think it's not here with us to stay, this new post-corona?
Well, I think it'll be definitely easier to work from home and more people are going to adopt that. The reason for the shelter in place is horrible. So there's pandemic, so it's not good for anybody. And hopefully by August, we'll be out.
But even if not, do you foresee a new way for collaboration? I mean, the technologies are here. We're not potentiating them as much as we could.
Yeah, we'll see increase in adoption. That's what I think. More people are going to get used to work remotely, but the moment the sanctions are going to be lifted, most humans are going to be happy to work face-to-face again. So, yeah, it's going to be a good day.
Yeah, I'm very excited, actually, about the potential that this is thrusting on us for new ways of collaboration. I'm engaged in it, and I'm more optimistic than ever that there are plenty of things that we can do. But today, we're dedicating our time to Noam. Noam, mein name?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me, guys.
So, first of all, how's your day going?
My day's okay. The sheltering in place, too, just like everyone else.
Are you excited or not so much about it? For another month, I think we just saw the six counties here.
You know, I'm not so excited, but I am on parental leave right now with my baby boy, and it is a special treat to get to have some quality time with my children. So I'm thankful for that. And at the same time, I'm also excited to see preschools reopen and everything go back to a bit more normality.
Well, we're very excited to have you, particularly because this is an area that we have not discussed yet of user research. And what we'd like to do for a start is we can just give us a quick 30-second backgrounder. What brought you here to Silicon Valley? And what are you doing today?
Yeah, so briefly, I was born and raised in Israel to British parents, which is why I sound this way. I served in the military for most of my service in an Air Force unit, which is in charge of Israel's missile defense systems. And when I left the military after 5 years or so, I worked as a civilian in one of the companies that produce Israel's missile defense systems, those same systems I was operating in the military. That was the first time I got into UX because I was kind of leading some of the UX within that team, developing these missile defense systems. And later on, wanting to dive deeper into that and become a better researcher, better UX professional, I chose to go to graduate school and get my PhD in psychology from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. During that degree and that experience of, you know, advanced research training, I realized that my two passions are research and technology, and the best way to marry those two is user research or UX research. It has many terms. And of course, the best place to do that to this day is Silicon Valley. So that brought me here. I've since worked at Airbnb, Intercom, and these days Wealthfront doing research. And today I'm director of user research at Wealthfront. So that's what I'm up to these days, except for being on parental leave, as I mentioned.
In Wealthfront today, you lead a group of user researchers. Could you maybe elaborate or explain a little bit what, in your eyes, user research is? What's the goal and what is the outcome and how it's being used in a company like Wealthfront or any other company?
Sure. So there are many ways to think of user research, but one of them is that understanding your users, your customers deeply enables you to significantly de-risk the product decisions you're making and reach far better outcomes. One of the issues that user research can help with quite a bit is that you can be tracking every single metric in the world, but then two things will surely happen at some point. One is that you're not measuring some things or you're not able to measure certain things that you can only understand through user research. And then the second thing is that those metrics and other quantitative measures will give you a lot of what's happening, but not the why. And user research can give you that why and help you understand at a much deeper level what's going on. So to be clear, metrics, the quantitative side, the qualitative side, they are complementary. And not only that, but user research can be quantitative and qualitative. We can get into that if you want. But ultimately, user research gives that deep understanding of the why behind what your users are up to. It helps you build better products and de-risk decisions that could be very costly if you get them wrong.
I'm finding this particularly interesting in the company that you're working for right now, because essentially you're functioning sort of like a startup, right? There's, I think, 200 employees or so. Whereas if you look at very large companies, let's say Facebook and Google, they all have their dedicated research departments. Can you talk a little bit about this unique opportunity? Because maybe research is not just for very large companies.
Absolutely. So we are indeed at Wealthfront about 200 people. Wealthfront is a financial technology company, and we are trying to really reinvent everything around how you save, plan, and passively invest your money. And re-envisioning something like passive investing or banking, which is something Wealthfront is getting into, it's an incredibly difficult challenge to accomplish. And at Wealthfront, research has been going on since the very start of the company. And it wasn't always done by researchers like myself. It was done by PMs. I know many PMs listen to this podcast, obviously. It was done by designers. Research is a very democratized process at Wealthfront compared to other companies. But at some point in a company's life, you do want to build out research, not just as a practice, but as a function. And that's what I was hired to do. And it helps us develop products that haven't really existed in the financial space before. And that's the goal. We want to develop very sophisticated tools that just a few years ago, people like you and me would never have access to in a million years. And now you do. That's a tough challenge without great insights and great research.
Can you pull some concrete examples? Because I think for many people, this whole area might be a little bit of an abstraction still. What does it look like in the life of a researcher? What does your day look like? How many people do you have on your team? How do you guys conduct the research?
Yeah, so I'll give some examples later on, but let's start with answering the latter part of that question. Sure. Kind of, what do we do? So I've worked at a bunch of companies, and the research team looked very different in each of those companies. To your point, some companies have research teams of hundreds of people, the Facebooks and Googles of the world. Others have dozens. And in many cases, companies have a team of one person. What researchers are doing is most typically collaborating with product PMs, especially, and design, and, you know, content strategy, marketing, everyone else on the typical cross-functional teams that we work on, to provide both strategic insights and tactical insights about the work. So a day in the life of a researcher could probably be composed of developing hypotheses and meeting with PMs and others to establish what it is we want to better understand to de-risk the project decisions. Then part of the day will be obviously engaging with the users themselves, whether it's through qualitative method like interviews, or whether it's through surveys or a bunch of other methods we use. Part of the day will surely be dedicated to analyzing and synthesizing all of the information we get, and then delivering it in a variety of forms, whether it's presentations or otherwise, to all of the stakeholders who are craving those insights to make their work easier. And I want to give a few very concrete examples of this work across the companies I worked for. So let's start with Airbnb. A while back while I was at Airbnb, I was working on the team that was in charge of the booking experience on Airbnb. And Airbnb had an overarching business goal to increase the use of Instant Book. Instant Book is a method of booking on Airbnb where you can instantly book a house and you'll be confirmed without having to wait, as opposed to having to wait up to 24 hours, what's known or what was known as request to book. The Instant Book is better for everyone involved. It was better for hosts, it was better for guests, and it was certainly better for the business. But Instant Book adoption was relatively low. And we had a bunch of metrics showing that, but we didn't understand why that is. Why aren't guests using Instant Book more often? Why aren't hosts offering Instant Book more often? Airbnb is a marketplace, so there are at least two sides to the equation. And through research, we understood that there were a variety of reasons why that was the case. Hosts were missing a bunch of tools that would enable them to accept bookings instantly without having to worry about it, such as calendar management tools, for example, that were missing. Guests had certain concerns or issues with booking a home instantly, which also needed to be addressed. All of these insights, we were not able to generate any other way besides user research because, again, all we knew from the data is how often it's being used or when or for which type of booking, etc.
What was the pushback from users exactly? Issue around the price or something else?
The guests.
Yeah, the guests. Sorry. Guests.
Okay. So, you know, it's not an easy decision which home to book, and sometimes you actually maybe want to ask additional questions. You have certain concerns about the home, so you would rather book it instantly, but you still want to know that extra thing maybe that, so, you know, you're not sure about, or maybe you're looking for a small discount or other things.
So it's around value or price. That's what I thought it was. Was that the primary?
Yeah, that can often be the case. It wasn't just that, but yeah. So that's a classic example of you have a marketplace, you have a lot of complexity, you have hosts, you have guests, you have a very important business goal, which benefits all sides of the marketplace and the business itself, and you have no idea how to really get there and how to generate an effective product roadmap that will bring InstantBook from something that was used well under 50% of the time to well over 50% of the time, which was, by the way, the eventual outcome. So that's one example. I also worked at Intercom, which is a B2B company, which, among other things, enables startups to communicate with their customers. And at my time at Intercom was developing a much more sophisticated customer support chatbot, which instead of sending people to articles, users who were looking for help with something, they would send people straight to the answers. This would obviously save customer support teams a huge amount of time, but these are models that need to be trained. So customer support people in companies and the product leaders working on those teams would have to train these models in order for them to help these agents support these businesses' customers. The issue here was, and again, this is something that you can only really understand with user research, was that we did not know how to train people or how to guide people on how they should train machine learning, AI-based platforms. What does that look like? Creating those flows was a completely new experience, both within Intercom and for everyone using this thing. And so a lot of the user research around that area was about how do we best explain to people basic concepts around training a machine learning model, and how do we make sure that customer support teams are effective at doing that, and making sure that this bot, this answer bot, provides the most relevant answers and support to their users and customers.
Quick anecdote of what particularly was learned from here.
People struggle to understand basic concepts like, how do I know that I've reached enough accuracy in my training? Like, when do I stop? Am I good to go now? So we had to make sure that people had the dashboards necessary, the information necessary to feel confident that they've trained the model to the extent they need to. And that's something that I think we realized through research and having people try this out. Like, how many questions do I need to train this model on? How many answers? What does solid beginning state look like? And where does this all go eventually? So that's one example. There are a few others. And then jumping to Wealthfront and what we're up to these days. At Wealthfront, we have a vision of what we call self-driving money. We want to enable people to invest with us, deposit their money with us, and then we can help them self-drive that money to where it needs to be in order to benefit them the most. This is the most advanced kind of passive investing tool that has existed. But that's incredibly tough. When you think about self-driving, we're just figuring that out with cars, and we're still quite far from being at a place where cars will be completely self-driving. With money, we're not there yet at all. And we are all used to checking our financial apps, banking apps, and other apps a bunch of times and making decisions very actively and you know, being somewhat involved in the process. So understanding what that looks like for our clients is definitely a challenge. And we're looking into that. We're trying to develop as many options as we can to have this autopilot work for people. And again, understanding what will enable people to understand what we're doing for them, trust us with their money, and trust the engines behind what we're doing to work properly is a very interesting challenge, which user research is currently informing.
So many times in research, you define a question and then you start a process or a sequence to basically answer a question. But if we knew all the questions to ask, that would be an easy task. How often do you encounter some data or some behavior that basically implies of a different question, something new that you should have asked and has a lot of value?
Yeah, I think I have three answers to that. It's a great point. So my first answer is that I believe every PM listening to this, every person listening to this, often gets a feeling that I'm about to make a decision and I have this nagging feeling that there's a certain risk here. I don't feel comfortable with this particular part of the experience, the flow, this thing I'm trying to build. That should be a research question. And you do know when that should be a question. So that's number one. Number two, research questions can come top down or bottom up. So research questions can come from executives and product leaders, design leaders, or even the CEO of a company. And they can come bottom up from anyone in the company, really, certainly researchers. The third point is that your question is exactly kind of one of the reasonings why you should hire researchers, dedicated researchers in the first place. We dedicate a significant portion of our career, our training, to understanding which questions work best, when to ask a question, why ask this question over another. That's what we do. We prioritize questions, and that's the training we get, whatever that training is. So that's a great plus one for hiring trained researchers.
So Norm, taking that one step in, people talk about using the scientific method, applying it in product design and strategy and building product. So how do you tackle setting the hypotheses, which is another way to say, to take nearest question one step in, and how do you answer for that hypothesis? Because I think that's what we're asking. I mean, there's metrics to test if your hypothesis was valid, but how do you tackle the right hypothesis?
Yeah, so at Wealthfront, we use what's quite a well-established method known as customer development. Customer development is really the scientific method applied to technology startups. It's part of the lean startup method, and it was developed by Steve Blank originally, who's a kind of a famed serial entrepreneur and writer and so much more. And the basic idea of customer development is exactly what you mentioned. It's generating hypotheses around what you think kind of your vision is, what fits with the business model, and figuring out whether those hypotheses have in fact some truth in them by putting them in front of your clients, your customers, your users, and testing them. If in those tests you find that this is something that's repeatable, that's scalable, that makes sense, if you see that delight in your clients' reactions, kind of paraphrasing my CEO poorly, Andy Ratcliffe, if you see them leaning over the table and begging you for your product, then there must be some truth to the hypothesis you made. And then once you establish that, then you can start executing on that product roadmap, then reevaluating the experience once you're towards the end with a series of what would typically be called kind of user tests or usability tests, just to make sure that you've tweaked the product well enough to match what the actual need is.
Can you shine some light on this topic from the perspective of going to market with an MVP, even just for testing purposes, just to prove that your hypothesis was true? And I know that there's lots and lots of ways of cutting corners and making mocks of the product that you're about to create as an MVP just to test to see if people will actually want it, but you can ask people in a survey, but once you ask people to give you their credit card, it's a completely different story, right? So how do you bridge that gap, in other words, through research? Maybe there's something I'm not aware of. How do you get to the point where you say, hey, you know what, let's try this $50,000 MVP, and then we'll draw our conclusions, but maybe before that we'll do a $2,000 pre-MVP. I mean, how does it all work?
So one of the tricks there is calibration, right? So I didn't mention the leaning over the table thing by chance. In a research setting, as opposed to when you're actually requesting a credit card, you need to see a very meaningful, strong reaction to something in order to have conviction that this is something meaningful, right? If someone just kind of casually says, yeah, you know, this kind of works for me, then clearly you have to dive much deeper into what's on that person's mind, because they are not excited about your product. So I would say my number one piece of advice for everyone who's listening to this is calibrate your expectations very high. Set the bar very high. You need to be seeing real excitement around what you're doing in order to say, well, this will probably work even when people need to put their credit card down and pay for this. There are also certain research techniques, things like the fake door method, when you essentially offer people the opportunity to sign up for a beta. You kind of make it seem as realistic as possible to see if people will actually put down details, maybe not payment details necessarily, but even just their personal details, to see if they're genuinely interested in the product. So there are certain research techniques to address that. But the number one thing is setting the bar really high in terms of what you expect to see and what that means.
Back in the day when I worked for Amazon, the product that I was responsible for is a web browser called Silk. Did you know that Amazon has a web browser?
So, I vaguely heard about it.
Yeah. So in any Amazon device, if you go online, you're using a web browser, it's called Silk. And we conducted a research about how people actually use that web browser. And the way we did it, we actually brought people to HQ, put them in rooms with a bunch of cameras, and just let them use the browser, like go to this link and then click on whatever is interesting to you.
Yeah.
We had a lot of skewed data with that specific method. You're not in your home environment. You're in a foreign area. You feel under surveillance. So you may change your behavior a little bit. What is a good way to replace such methods? So for companies that don't use credit cards, but use other things, companies like Facebook or Google, what is a good way to conduct research without bringing customers to your research facility?
Let me just make that even more complex. Add to that the fact that a lot of things are just a marginal change, let's say an addition of a feature. It's a completely different picture to research that versus to take a concept that has never been launched yet. It is completely still in theory, and you could describe it to someone, but they wouldn't even understand where to start because they've never even felt it. Imagine the iPhone before it was launched like that. How do you go about actually testing for that without actually having an MVP in your hands, putting people in that experience to then say, well, what do you think?
Yeah. So first of all, kind of the first question is incredibly pertinent for right now. We started this conversation talking about shelter in place, the global pandemic that's going on right now. We are all stuck at home. We cannot do research right now at our headquarters. We're only doing remote research. And to your point, Ofer, about, you know, new tools and how the world may change after this, research will also change after this and develop quite a bit. And luckily for us, today more than ever, we have great research tools that enable us to do research when people are in the same context as when they would be using this software, this app, their devices, and so forth. One of those tools, for example, is a tool called DScout, which enables researchers to conduct diary studies. Diary studies are when we track people throughout their lives, their daily lives, for a week, 2 weeks, a month, and we see what they do while they are in the context that we care about. So for example, at Wealthfront, we are a fintech company. And so we deal with what happens when people get their salaries and they move that money into different accounts and they might invest some of that money and so forth. With a diary study, we can have people report on video surveys with their mobile phone while they are performing those actions, and we can watch them, we can understand them, we can see what they're doing right in the context that matters to us most. That's a huge benefit compared to bringing people into a very artificial kind of surrounding like a lab. So that's, I think, a first important point. And I would encourage, again, people who are thinking about this particular problem to look into tools like Dscout, tools like Lookback, and various other tools I'm happy to talk about, and we can add them in the show notes later on or whatever, tools that enable you to conduct research right in the context. Now, to your second question, Ophir, it's very hard to compress time and bring people with you into a future that you have not yet created. That's a huge challenge. And honestly, I would typically avoid that altogether. I think ultimately the way to avoid that is to focus on barriers that people have in their lives, then try and develop products for that. There's this principle in storytelling. I forget whose it is. I should know this. But the idea is that in every good story, you have inertia, you have someone trying to do something, and there are barriers, and that person is removing barriers. It's a way of thinking about research as well. We talk to people, we understand their barriers, and we strive to remove them. When you think about it like that, it doesn't really matter if you can present the future or you can't present the future. You know, it doesn't matter, because if you understand what the barrier is, what people really just want to accomplish and can't, that's all you really need to start developing great products.
We got to the final section, and it's the creative corner of our podcast. So we just want to get a feel for your creativity, Noam. Pick a product in a parallel reality. What would you build if money, you know, for funding it wouldn't be an issue? Something you'd love.
So I've recently gotten into content creation myself. I realized that I was having a bunch of conversations with people one-on-one that were interesting to me, and I really wanted to share them. I realized I have so many thoughts in my brain that I'm not able to get out. And I realized, just like you did, I'm sure, that we're all stuck at home and we're just dying to interact with people and interact with the world. And I discovered that it's incredibly challenging. It's going to be difficult to create, even today, with all of the tools that exist, because they are so all over the place. And you need like 10 or 20 different tools, in some cases, just to put something out there. And so I think what I would choose these days, because I'm kind of getting into content creation and just sharing some knowledge and inspirations with the world, it would be something around that. It would be kind of an all-in-one platform that enables you to create, share, monitor, engage with crowds. I mean, I have a list of those tools right now, and I'm literally using already probably 10 or 15 tools just for that. And it's all over the place, and the integrations aren't so good. And so some people might disagree. That might be a different viewpoint from others, but for me, that's been the experience.
What are some ways to reach you? Certainly, I'm going to reach afterwards to poke around, because it sounds like we could use some of this to wrap it into what we're doing at realvr.ai.
So I'm always, always happy to connect. I'm a huge extrovert. I care a lot about mentorship and coaching, and I would love nothing more than to support other product people, researchers, and anyone else who's listening to this with whatever it is you need. I think I'm the most available either on LinkedIn, just look me up, Noam Siegel, currently at Wealthfront, you'll find me very quickly, or on Twitter at NoamSeg, NoamSeg. My DMs are open, and you're welcome to get in there and send me a message. Not hiring currently, I'm sure that'll change once we go back to more normality. But again, I'm more than happy to help mentor people, provide some more information, advice. I love working with founders and entrepreneurs and product people, and anyone who wants to build something in this world and isn't quite sure how to get the insights necessary to do that well.
Thank you.
Yeah, really enjoyed this. Thank you so much and have a great day there.
It was my pleasure. Thank you as well. And stay healthy and safe, everyone.
Thanks.